Many of the presentations so far have been very, I would say, not pessimistic in their approach, but rather they have outlined something very dystopian in many ways. I think that the first half of my presentation will also be a bit dystopian, but I will try to give a few practical advices on how we can actually resist these developments that we see coming from warfare, and I will talk about surveillance and the societies of control that are emerging from the military, from technologies developed in the military-industrial complex, and from operational strategies that have been deployed in warfare. Just a few remarks on my background. I am the editor of the Resistance Studies magazine, which is an open access publication, and you can find it on rsmag.org. So I am doing research on resistance movements and different kinds and aspects of political resistance. I also run with a colleague of mine this other project called panspectracism.org, and I will explain in a minute what this concept of panspectracism means to us and how we can use that to understand surveillance. I am also... I'm also a member of the Resistance Studies Network, which is a global network, and but we have seminars locally in Gothenburg. You can find out more about this on resistancestudies.org, and you can also become a member. It's for free, and we have a blog, and we have different kinds of publications there as well. So I will try to highlight three major questions here. How can we understand new technologies of surveillance in contemporary societies? So that would be a way of understanding the historical emergence of certain technologies that surround us constantly. And then I will try to maybe not answer, but at least raise the question, how can we resist certain developments that we do not like for some reason? Or resistance sounds a bit dramatic. I will include also how to form a critical a public opinion about these issues that do not emerge by themselves. We have to kind of do it our way. And the third question will be a reflection, I would say, more or less. Should we negate technology? Should we go out in the forest and try to avoid technology as much as possible if we see all these negative consequences? Or should we actually affirm technology? As you can see, I have computers and cell phones all over me, so I'm more or less affirming technology. I've already made an answer to that question. But yeah, those are the main topics that I will discuss. So let me start with the descriptive question. I have a long quote here, and it's by a philosopher of the name Manuel de Landa. And he writes, he's a historian and a philosopher, and he writes about changes that happened after the Second World War. And he says that there emerged from the military the NSA, and we have the equivalents here, Bundesnachrichtendienst in Germany, and all over the world, these intelligence organizations, they actually found a new huge problem, and this intensified during the Cold War, that surveillance was stuffed with too much information. So these they have these antenna farms, which are huge antennas, and they started to listen to radio traffic. So the United States listened to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union probably listened back. And there was too much information in the ether. So we see the emergence of intercepting and collecting data, and then we needed computers in order to organize and systematize and reduce the complexity of the multiplicity of information that was in the air. So Manuel de Landa calls this, instead of the panopticon, which I will define a bit later, he said that there is a panspectrum emerging. And this panspectrum, well, the Greek word pan means everything, and spectrum is spectrum, means that everything within all spectrums will be gathered and then analyzed. And this happened during the 1950s and onwards. And I would argue that this military innovation will have or has had severe consequences that we see today. Because if we look at the paradigmatic technologies of the modern societies, industrial societies, we see, for example, the assembly line of production, which we usually know as Fordism, and for social control, we have the prison, which where we can put, well, people who have committed crimes, and the factories that have produced all this abundance of houses and cars and traditional technologies were mainly energy-based. And there is, in a way, an abstract pattern here relating. We have the factories were resembling prisons in the sense that they were spaces of enclosure, so workers had to be in factories for 8 or 10 or 14 hours a day. And the prison was designed in order to survey, not only to keep prisoners inside a physical building, but they also needed to be surveyed. And I would argue that all these institutions, the school, the prison, the factory, and so on, are central institutions in modern society. And they are more and more being challenged. If we look at these concepts of the information society, or we see how the energy-based production are being moved away from the Western societies and moved to low-wage countries, and we see the emergence of intellectual property and information as the new factories of the highly industrial societies are more and more information-based. I would argue that there is a new set of technologies emerging that are more or less panspectric in this sense. And this comes from a military development, but it is now being more and more deployed in civil applications. So we have very many new ways of gathering information that cover a much larger spectrum than just a simple surveillance camera. We have, for example, RFID chips, and just by going on the internet, we leave so many traces, so many pieces of information scattered around us. For example, if you're on Facebook, you are in real time giving away information about yourself. With the increased digitalization, the title of this conference is Peace and War Digital. So we want to look at the digital technologies. And more and more of, for example, if we look at everybody has a cell phone nowadays, which means that there is a historical opportunity for locating people in space, which means that if you have access to the databases of the cell phone operators, you will know in real time where most people in Germany or Sweden are at within an accuracy of maybe 30 meters. This also, we have had a few presentations that were elaborating on the history of the internet, and we have seen the increasing computational power. And this computational power is, of course, needed in order to make social network analysis and data mining, which are also paradigmatic soft technologies. So my main argument is that the panoptic social diagram that included factories and prisons and so on, and energy-based production, is more and more being accompanied, not, I wouldn't say replaced, by this panspectric. And we see this in warfare. I think yesterday there were a few notions of this full spectrum dominance warfare and so on. So the level of the information sphere is being more and more utilized as means of warfare, but I would say even more for surveillance. So, and we might go to wonder why did this happen? Why did this develop? And then we also have to go back to warfare. So Paul Virilio is, or was, a French historian and philosopher. He said that speed is essential when it comes to technological development. And this is because in the military, speed is essential for turning distance into action, which means that if you are very quick, you can act before somebody else acts. And we see this very clearly in the case of jet fighters. This is a Swedish jet fighter called Viggen. It was developed in the 1970s. And you can see that during the post-war era, there was a huge struggle in getting the quickest jet fighter, because if you had the fastest one, you could turn distance into action. And this is one example. But I would say we can take this argument and transfer it to signals intelligence. Because in signals intelligence, you want to prevent, for example, terrorism. So you want to get the information you need, you want to get as much information as possible in order to act before the terrorist blows a bomb. And this means that you are, well, from a legal point of view, this is very complicated, because if you are trying to do pre-crime, you're acting with violence before a crime has been committed, well, you couldn't really go to a court. You couldn't sentence somebody for that, because this person is already dead. This happened, for example, in London. Charles de Menezes was killed in London, in the subway, because he was suspected being a terrorist, but they found out he was innocent. But the problem is that you need to act before a terrorist strike. So you need to turn distance, the distance you need to, you know, move around and mobilize your weapons, into action. And but then the problem becomes, I mean, with terrorism, many people are willing to accept some kind of violence and to counter it. But the problem with, if you take this signals intelligence and you take this mode of operation and you move it into a completely civil domain, such as the internet, you get very, very severe results. So if you can take all the internet traffic in Germany and you make a copy of it, and then you use this in order to do preemptive crime prevention, you have a problem, because if you're fighting crimes that have not yet been committed, it's a very big problem from a legal point of view. So this turning distance into action can lead to a kind of preemptive territorialization. If you have all the cell phones and you find patterns about somebody, or if somebody's going to rob a bank, and you target this person before he or she robs the bank, it becomes a problem from a legal point of view. I'm going to make to have a quick example from science fiction. If you have seen the movie Minority Report, it's about this pre-crime. They have the people with pre-cognitive abilities that are able to predict the future. We don't have these. This is science fiction. But instead of these pre-cognitive abilities, we use computers. And this is taking place now. It's taking place in Sweden, which would be my example. The FRA is the Swedish National Defense Radio Establishment. It's similar to the NSA, Bundesnachrichtendienst, and MI6, and so on. And they have recently passed a law allowing this FRA to make a copy of all internet traffic and to analyze it. And then you probably say, well, you can't really make a copy of the internet. There is so much information going back and forth. And this is true in one sense when it comes to content data. So if you download a movie, for example, the FRA will not copy the movie, but they will instead copy what is called traffic data. And traffic data is for every single file that you download on the internet, there is metadata attached to it. And metadata consists of at what time, to which IP address, and so on. And this traffic data, this is what we really want. We don't want to get all the movies and MP3 files that we download, or images, or software. We want to get this traffic data, because with traffic data, you can build social network analysis. So if I send an email to one of you, if you intercept that message, the traffic data, you can make a link between me and somebody out here that I'm sending an email to. And if this person sends another email to another person, we have more links. When I'm on Facebook, I have a few hundred friends, and they form links to me, right? Abstract links. So you can start to analyze the behavior and the patterns of people, and which people, who they communicate with, and so on. And this is one of the ways of detecting terrorists. We want to find the terrorist cells. They are leaderless. They are self-organizing, and the FRA and the NSA probably, they think that this is a good means of finding terrorists, because if you can make knowledgeable the links and the social links between people, you can find these terrorist cells. But it requires also that you get all information, which means physically that the FRA will need to plug themselves in with a physical cable to the central fiber cables in Sweden. They will do this next year. Anyway, it's not only these intelligence organizations that are doing this. It's become, this type of panspectric surveillance has become very popular among private companies, such as Walmart, for example, is the best example. It is also a very good way of rationalizing production. So, for example, Walmart, they want to predict consumer behavior, so they want to know that if they have one of these grocery stores in New York, they want to be able to say that next week we will sell 300 packs of cornflakes in this particular store, because then we can optimize logistics, and we can optimize the pricing, and we can optimize the commercials. So this is why they analyze the behavior of consumers in order to predict what they want, what they're going to do in the future, and so on. So if you know that one consumer has had a laundry machine for 5 years, you know that it will be very probable that in year six this washing laundry machine will break down, and this consumer is a very potential consumer. And in many ways, this is also used by airlines, it's used by credit card companies, and so on. So the key aim is to know you better than you know yourself as a consumer, from a consumer perspective. Now, I'm going to talk about resistance, because I would say that with the technologies that surround us, they form this panspectric territory. You cannot do anything without leaving electronic footprints. You cannot go on the internet, you cannot use your cell phone, you cannot use your credit card, so the world that we live in is soaked with electronic footprints. So this is why it's very omnipotent, the everyday life is completely consumed by these modes of surveillance or potential surveillance. The problem of traffic data has no clear solution if we're going to protect ourselves. I cannot protect my computer from being in a traffic data analysis because it's a property of the structure of the internet. Also, another challenge, if you want to resist this, is that there are so many counter-arguments saying that, okay, so you're against this type of surveillance. What about terrorism? What about our children going to school? What if there is a terrorist? This imaginary safety that is produced by surveillance. If you put a camera here, we feel more safe, somebody might argue. This is also a challenge. And another challenge is, of course, the anti-terrorist legislations that have found this gray zone within legal procedures that if you're a suspected terrorist, you can immediately have your accounts frozen and so on. But from the Swedish case, and I was partially participating in this kind of struggle to stop this law about internet surveillance, there are actually many positive sides to it. And I would like to stress those. Even though we can see that the surveillance societies are approaching us very quickly, there is actually potentials when you affirm technology and you use the internet and you use the new media in order to build a public opinion. So in the Swedish case, there was this notion of citizen journalism actually was on the agenda all the time, because most of the research or reading these legal documents, finding out how internet surveillance really works, was performed by activists and bloggers. And we built wikis, like the Wikipedia, user-generated knowledge bases, in order to have more precise arguments and to find out what this FRA thing was all about. And since I'm from the humanities, I don't have any technical expertise, but I could cooperate then with engineers. And so a person from the humanities could cooperate with one engineer and one person from law, and then all of a sudden we could start making good arguments and find out what this was all about. There is also a case in Sweden, maybe you have heard, in Germany there is the Piratenpartei, so the Pirates Party, which is actually a party running for the government or for the parliament. And I would say that there is in Sweden now a general mobilization because of this issue that emerged. There is also other forms of resistance which are, I would say, more not undemocratic, but are kind of on the doesn't really care about the democratic procedure and do not apply to the parliaments, such as the hacktivism movements that are developing softwares and methods in order to be able to not be detected. So I can try to protect my computer. I can try to protect my computer from being in a sociogram or a social network analysis by having my computer, I think it's doing that right now, sending random messages to search engines, which will cause a very random and scattered footprint from my computer right now. I hope that nobody will detect me. We see also there are a few examples. There is the, as I mentioned, the Pirate Party. The FRApedia is like the Wikipedia, it runs the same software. And if you want to know anything about the FRA, you have tons of information here. And there is also, I would say, the internet. If you use the internet as a means of communication, you can be quick. And as I mentioned, speed turns distance into action. And this is really the case in Sweden, because most of the activists are constantly online by some means. Either they are on a computer, or they have cell phones, or they have, you know. But by having all these consumer technologies ready at hand, you can act very quickly. So this picture here, this is a Swedish parliament building. And this demonstration here took place as a very self-organized thing. when the government was passing this law, on the internet, the people were saying, let's go and face the politicians. And then, I mean, then you have to apply for permission. It's illegal to have a demonstration without a permission in Sweden. I think that's the case in Germany too. But since this speed of using internet-based technologies made it more or less impossible for anyone to react to this very quick organization. And even as I mentioned, Facebook is one of the most intrusive software that you can use. But still, we use it in order to organize. So you have the most, probably the most surveyed area of the internet, where you can affirm this area and and say that I don't care about surveillance. And we have over here 12,000 members, I think, in one of those groups that act against. And one of these groups form a coordinated, so you can maybe get 12,000 people out demonstrating in a just within a few minutes. So let me conclude. What I would say is crucial here, and in order to build some kind of positive resistance and to build criticism that will make these issues arise, because I think the most dangerous thing is if governments and administrations and if this only has a bureaucratic implementation, if we get surveillance all around us and nobody is asking any critical questions, I think it can be really serious for civil liberties and for the, what do you say in German? Menschenrechte? That's the same as civil liberties, yeah. Okay, so I'm learning. So I think that we need to cooperate. I think there is, and I think that I feel very happy cooperating, for example, asking people from informatics or computer engineering about these complex issues. And then I go to my other colleague, who's a PhD student in law, and we start to work together in order to produce a good and valid argument. So that's one conclusion. And the other conclusion is that there is a potential to do something, to organize a public formation around these issues using, and this potential is inherent more or less in the internet as a communications medium, because it is decentralized. It allows and it makes communication very easy, very fast. It makes communication very, so to say, you can easily form communities and local points of resistance just by using all these new features of the internet. And the last conclusion is that internet surveillance was born 50 years ago with signals intelligence, and So we can actually make maybe a reverse or another kind of argument that technologies developed in the context of war may be devastating when used in times of peace. So peace itself will not save us. This is why we need to focus on what happens in our societies when we think that when we only see war on television. We need to ask what's going on in my backyard, what's going on in my computer. In times of peace, when we apply technologies of warfare on ourselves, we need to maybe realize that war is closer to our everyday lives than we thought. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening.